We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Well, there's certainly no shortage of major scientific reports on the pressing problems of our time, things like sustainability and climate change, just to name two. More often than not, these reports, after they are written, end up sitting on a shelf somewhere and gathering dust. And the people who are in a position to make policy seldom read them. And that it's not just something that happens here in the United States. It happens in a lot of other places as well. In this part of Focus 580, we'll try to talk a little bit about bridging the gap between science and policymaking. And our guest for the program is Roger Casperson. He's a research professor and distinguished scientist in the Graduate School of Geography at Clark University. That's in Worcester, Massachusetts. He's done a lot of writing on issues connected with risk analysis and communication, also with global environmental change and environmental policy. He's a member of the National Academy of Sciences and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He's been honored by the Association of American Geographers for his research on hazards, also was a recipient of the 2006 Distinguished Achievement Award of the Society for Risk Analysis. And he's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. We'll give a talk. This is in the Climate and Society Speaker Series. That's a series of the Social Dimensions of Environmental Policy Initiative, which is a campus-wide initiative that involves the Department of Geography, School of Earth Society and Environment, and also the Beckman Institute. And he'll be giving a talk on the campus this afternoon at 2:30 in Burrell Hall. That's on Goodwin Avenue in room 124, talking about this very subject, closing the gap between science and practice. And I'm sure anyone who is interested should stop by and hear what he has to say this afternoon. But of course, here on the program, as we talk, questions are welcome too. We just ask people to be brief. That way we can get as many callers in as possible. But comments, questions certainly are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and also toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are certainly welcome. Well, thank you very much for being here.
I'm delighted to be able to visit and be part of what I think is an extraordinarily good series that Jesse Ribeau has put together here at the University of Illinois.
Great. You know, over the years, I've been doing this for a while, and I expect I probably have talked with a number of people who were involved in putting together various kinds of reports. I've certainly talked with a lot of people who have authored books looking at some particular subject and looking at what research was available. And then invariably, the final chapter of the book is their 10-point program or 20-point program or something for approaching the problem. And you know, we have our conversation, and I think, well, that's good. We put the spotlight on some particular issue, and we've gotten some ideas out. But I do find myself thinking these books and these reports, who reads them? How many people read them? And then does that ever get translated into any kind of policy? And it sounds as if what you're suggesting is that probably most of the time, they don't get translated into policy, and those people who are really in a position to make policy, and I suppose that might be federal bureaucrats or might be members of Congress or whoever, they don't read these things. Do I have that right?
No, we think that's right. And as I mentioned today during my lecture, we actually tried to look into this a little more deeply and took a number of 20, 25 reports and said, well, here are some key reports that should have played a major role with how people are making decisions and how public officials are informing themselves of what the big issues are. And we found out most of those reports had not been read. They're read by other scientists and so forth, but the scientists think that they're doing something important for decision makers, but it's not happening.
Yeah. I think probably in my case, a lot of the people that I talk to are in the social sciences, but I'm sure that I have talked with other kinds of scientists as well. Does this predominantly touch on hard science, and so we're talking about things like environmental issues, for example, or climate change. Does it sort of apply across the board, whether you're talking about social science issues and things that have to do with politics and society, as well as issues like sustainability and climate change and so forth?
Yeah, I think it's true of both types of scientists, both the physical scientists and life scientists and on one hand, and the social scientists on the other. But it's probably even worse for the social sciences than for the physical science. I think the physical sciences fare a little bit better, and people tend to give them, I don't know, a little more credence or a little more importance or so forth. Although if you take a problem like climate change, most of the important questions we're seeing now, we've made a lot of progress on climate science, but not very much progress on what are going to be the impacts on human systems and communities and those kinds of questions.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me come right to the question then. Why your observation was that the kind of reports that we're talking about, they're not being read, at least they're not being read by policy makers, policy people. They may be read by other scientists. Maybe a journalist here and there are reading them. Why is it that the policy, people who are in the position to make the policy, they're not reading them?
I think we can give some blame to both the scientists and the policymakers in this. I don't think it's purely the fault of the policymakers. The scientists, in fact, are really writing out of curiosity-driven subjects rather than major problems that we're trying to deal with in society. And they're assuming that the things that they're interested in is what the decision-maker needs to know about. And the decision-maker frequently picks up one of these reports and says, well, I'm not really finding in this the kinds of things that I need to know about. So that's nice that you did that work and so forth, but it's not relevant to my problem. So, and then I think there's a problem on the other side that frequently the reports do have significance and do have valuable information for the decision makers. But as people, I live in Washington, and as people in Washington will tell you, policymakers don't read.
Well, I'm sure that if they were going to read, the volume of material that they might have to choose from would be awfully big.
No. And so I think it's not an easy thing. On the other hand, and I'll give an example. I've been involved in a review of the Department of Homeland Security, and Congress has sent this. It's a new department, and Congress has sent them several letters sort of saying, we don't really understand what you're doing with vulnerability analysis. Can you clarify what framework you really use and how you analyze problems of what are our vulnerable critical infrastructures and who are the people that are going to be most affected by a terrorist incident and so forth. And, as part of this group, I was part of a group being briefed by the department on this subject, and I happened to work on vulnerability questions. And so I said to the people who were briefing us, there's a lot of work coming out in this area. There are a number of new books and people have proposed frameworks. Why don't you just take one of those frameworks and use it? And they sort of looked blank. And I said, well, I assume you are reading these books and you have somebody looking at them and you know what these frameworks are. And they acknowledged, no, they didn't have anybody looking at it. And they really weren't aware of, is there things that they should be looking at and could I make some suggestions? And so you get that kind of problem as well. I think the problems sit in science. Because of what the scientists are trying to do, they're really not trying to solve the problem of the decision maker. And the decision maker is frequently unaware or not making good use of work that is relevant and that could be helpful to them.
Well, that's so it sounds, at least in it, taking that last little story that you told, it's not a matter of the book being on the shelf and them just walking by it every day and not taking it down and looking at it. It sounds as if it's not even on their shelf. I mean, they don't even know that that book. It's not that they're ignoring it; they don't even know that book exists.
Yeah, as I'll say this afternoon in this little survey that we did, in which we looked at 25 different major studies that we thought were important to decision makers. In 50% of the cases, the decision maker didn't even had never heard of this report, had no idea it existed. It was not on their shelves. And so it was really not having any impact on what they did.
So whose issue is that? I mean, I would think in one respect that it might be the issue of the individual who generated the report or the group, or that there's got to be some interest group there who would at the very least think, we need to send a copy of the, you know, send their, you know, you hear about these things where somebody has something and they send a copy to every member of Congress.
But even sending is really not enough. And what people, because they'll get the report and then it will sit on the shelf and they'll probably never look at it. But as a number of people who have tried to look at this problem are arguing these days, we need to have more collaborative kind of work. We need to have the decision makers not getting the report at the end and trying to see whether there's anything interesting in it for them. Rather, that when we start, we need at least some of our science to really have the decision makers involved from the start and saying what we need to know about is X, Y, and Z. And then the scientists will do some of the scientific questions, but also make sure that they gather information and analysis that the decision maker really wants to know about. And then there's a chance that the report will be read.
How much of this might have something to do with the ability or the inability of the scientists to communicate what it is they are interested in and what it is they've learned to people who are not scientists?
Yeah, and I think scientists, as many people have found, are really not very good at that, by and large. Most of us are relatively poor communicators. And but again, I mean, some things can be done to do a better job of that. But again, one of the problems is that the material that's being communicated is not that interesting or valuable to decision makers. And we need to make sure that we have a content in at least some important part of our scientific work that is really directed at decision making and at policy questions and so forth. So we're not only advancing the field of science, but we're also trying to provide knowledge, a knowledge base to decision making that is going to lead to better decisions on environmental and other kinds of problems.
Yeah. I wonder, though, I could imagine that some scientists would have this reaction that says, well, if before I start to do my inquiry, if I'm talking with policy people and they're telling me what they want to know, what that's going to do is narrow my field of vision. It's rather than my looking without preconceptions about what's important, without what I think I'm going to find, which is what science is supposed to be all about, that instead this may be pushing me into a direction where somebody's going to end up hearing what it is they want to hear because they've set up the questions to start with, and that would maybe go some way to determining what the answers are going to be.
Yeah, and I think if we were suddenly to convert our science to really have it all defined by decision makers and so forth, that would be really unfortunate. So I wouldn't be happy to have the decision makers framing all the questions. I want that to be a collaborative process. I want the scientists and the decision makers to be talking and arguing about this and coming to agreement on some set of important questions. And also, I think it's important that we not lose traditional science in this, because we need that science to keep advancing our scientific knowledge about various phenomena out in the world. Some people have argued that what we need are really two kinds of science. We need what people call the curiosity-driven or the traditional science of trying to advance the frontiers of knowledge at all times in the scientific process. But then we need another kind of science that is really directed to solving problems. and to try to inform the decision process around critical questions. And so it's an argument that we need a sustainability science and we need a curiosity-driven science. We need both kinds of, and we don't want to convert all of what has been really good about our scientific process to dealing with the needs of decision makers, and particularly have decision makers define all those problems. That would be unfortunate.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Roger Casperson. He is a research professor and distinguished scientist in the Graduate School of Geography at Clark University in Worcester, Mass. He's written a lot on things like risk analysis and communication, on global environmental change, on environmental policy. He's here visiting the campus to give a talk on this subject of the gap between science and practice, and the fact that it seems that people who do scientific research, scientists, and people who make policy, maybe they don't talk to each other the way that they should, or at least the kind of research that the scientists is often not read by the policy people. Questions welcome, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Part of the problem, I guess it sounds as if the policy people and the scientists just live in two different worlds, and that they very rarely intersect. You know, maybe when the scientists come in and they testify before Congress or you know, something like that. But that otherwise, those two worlds, they just don't touch.
I think that's often the case, and I want to say, particularly for the listeners who may be out there, that well, the United States is not like every other country in this matter. I think we do, in many ways, have a bigger problem. We have a constitution and a national setup of our political institutions that has always had perhaps even more than a healthy measure of distrust of expertise and science in our society. And we've just been through 8 years of an administration that, in some sense, prided itself on keeping a pretty strong barrier between science and the political process. A little bit earlier this year, the new administration, President Obama, gave a major talk to the National Academy of Sciences in which he made a pledge that science was going to be listened to much more carefully in the coming years in this new administration. Well, we'll see. That's not an easy thing to achieve, I think, but there is a situation in the United States of a setup to our institutions and the way Congress functions and the courts function and so forth, in which science has not played as major a role as it does. I spent 4 years working in Sweden, and the Swedes would sort of argue that any major environmental problem, of course you have to contact all the major scientists who work on this question. It would never occur to us not to do that. And I think there is a practice that occurs in Sweden of closely consulting science on many of these problems that just doesn't happen in the United States. So we also have some particular in our culture and in our institutions, a distance that has existed throughout our history between science and Congress. And we all know that Congress has filled mostly of lawyers, and there are only several scientists actually in Congress, and science does not play the same kind of role in the United States in the making of public policy that I think it does in many other societies. Mm.
I guess it was my understanding, though, that the kind of problem that we're talking about was also not unique to the United States, that if you go to other industrial countries, and I don't know what the experience would be in Britain or France or Germany or, you know, any place, or Japan or any place else you want to name, how many other places would maybe say, like Sweden, be actually doing substantially better, or how many other places you could essentially point to the same problem and say, well, pretty much we have that problem. They have that problem there too.
Yeah, and I think it is true that this is a general problem. But to take an example, the notion, for example, that you could have major scientific work going on, and people in our federal agencies in the Congress don't have time to read anything. I think is not something that I found in other societies. I remember once a number of years ago, maybe 7 or 8 years ago now, being invited to give a major talk to government officials in the health and safety executive in Britain, and it was really a new experience for me because I started giving my talk. And then people were raising their hand with questions. And it was obvious that a bunch of people there had read the reports that I was talking about and had read my previous work and had questions about things that I had said in the document. I've never had, you know, I've been in the United States, very involved in governmental and policymaking in the United States. So I've never had that experience.
All right. Let's talk with, we have a caller here in Urbana, here where we are. Line one. Hello.
Hi. Yeah, I'm a little unhappy with this discussion. It seems fairly abstract in a way. Can we have some more specifics and say a couple from physical sciences and a couple from social sciences or something and actually really discuss what the reports are and who hasn't read it and that sort of stuff?
Okay. Well, can you do that?
Well, let's take an example like that there's a lot of concern about now, climate change. And I think that the IPCC major report, this is the major body of analysis and knowledge on climate change that's been conducted mostly by in the hard sciences. And I still find when I sit in meetings in Washington and so forth, many of the people working in government or the consultants who are advising them and so forth sometimes don't even know what the acronyms stand for and by and large have not read the reports coming out of there, even though everybody's concerned about climate change and we're soon going to be moving to some kind of new legislation on climate change, and we'll see how much science plays a role in that.
I'm not sure I know what IPCC stands for.
Yeah, it's the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and it is the world's group of scientists who have tried to assess what the dangers of climate change are and how likely it is and so forth. It's probably okay that you don't know what it is and haven't read it, but if you're sitting in Congress or you're sitting in the Environmental Protection Agency or the Department of Energy, you better know that.
Does that get at your
question? Well, that's one example, but I'd like some more stuff. So I'll hang up.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Are there other examples you might want to give?
Well, we probably could find another. Let me give just one other example that is drawn from my recent experience. Since the events at the World Trade Center, we've had a lot of concern about the risks of terrorism in the United States, and it's a difficult area for science because we don't have a high knowledge base of who these actors are who might want to wreak havoc in the United States from some new kinds of attacks and so forth. So there is a scientific effort that is going on terrorism. But it's also an area in which it's very clear that the science needs to be very broad-based. It needs to address the social impacts that may happen on this, not only loss of life. It may be that the terrorist is really not interested primarily in producing loss of life or damaging a bridge or a road or so forth. It may be that they want to create havoc in the population. And we have an ongoing effort scientifically to understand these questions, but no work is really being funded in the social science questions connected with that. So we have a very uneven science, and the science that's there is not being used because those aren't seen yet. They will be, I think, eventually, as the really relevant problems that need to be addressed. And this is unlike the case in other societies where I think much more attention is being paid to the scientific work that's been done in that area, not in the U.S., where we're probably spending more money than any other country on these questions.
We have another caller. I'll get to in just a moment. We're a little bit past our midpoint. Let me introduce again the guest, Roger Casperson. He's a research professor, distinguished scientist at the Graduate School of Geography at Clark University in Worcester, Mass. Has written a lot about things like risk analysis and communication, also global environmental change. He's here to give a talk. This is part of a speaker series of the Social Dimensions of Environmental Policy Initiative. And that is something that is an initiative of the Department of Geography, the School of Earth, Society, and Environment, and the Beckman Institute here at the University of Illinois. They have had a couple of people speak in this series already, and they will have some folks also next year. And our guest, Roger Casperson, will be speaking at Burrell Hall on the campus, 124 Burrell, at 2:30 this afternoon. That's on South Goodwin. And you want to stop by, you can do that. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And we have another caller here also, Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. I guess this is just a comment. I just returned from an elder hostel in the Carbondale area where a Southern Illinois University professor of weather debunked global warming, and I was quite distressed. He made fun of Al Gore's film, and it's really alarming to me that he's a professor and he's teaching the young people at Southern Illinois University. I'll just hang up and hear your comments.
No, I don't know. Can you comment?
Well, the only thing I would say is that there's an overwhelming consensus in science, as I think the caller noted. So there's not perfect agreement in the sciences, and that's a typical state of science, I think, that you may have an overwhelming consensus, but you always have some minority or dissent voices. And usually over time, the debates that generates and so forth are very useful. Now, it is interesting that in the United States just recently, I've had some people tell me, though I haven't seen the data myself, that recent polls show that the public, at the time that science is becoming more and more convinced about the dangers of global warming, the public is moving in the opposite direction, and that there's less public consensus and more public questioning about what the dangers really are and what science has to say about it. And I'm interested to try to, I think a number of people are interested in, it's counterintuitive that would be occurring. So why is it happening? Does that suggest a particular role for the media? Are the dissenting scientists really, do they have high access to getting their message out to the public in the way that the mainstream scientists are not being successful? How do we explain these divergent trends going on, what seem to be divergent trends in the United States?
Mm-hmm. Well, do you have some thoughts on that right off? And I imagine that some of the things that you touched on, you'd have to say, well, it does have something to do with the way that the issue is covered in the media. Certainly, that would be one of the first things I would think about.
I think one of my concerns about media coverage about environmental problems generally is, I think the media actually struggle very hard to try to give a fair and objective appraisal of what climate change or, you know, nuclear power or you name it, whatever the particular issue is. But typically the way that they do that is not to try to reflect the mainstream opinion, but to get someone who's a skeptic and someone who's totally committed to the two and report both of those with the notion that that's a fair, even-handed treatment. But from studies on how people respond to risk and so forth, what we know is that if you give people a very scary message and you give them a very comforting message, that they're often not going to put that together in an even-handed, judicial kind of way. And in a problem like climate change, where the effects are not going to happen tomorrow, by and large, but are going to take place sometime in the future, I think there's very often the reaction of, well, we got a lot of other problems to deal with right now, and if we're not going to have these problems until 10 years from now, well, let's see how it plays out over the next 10 years. Hmm. So I think it's also the case that the skeptics and the dissidents are being very well funded, have high access to the media, and are very effective at getting their message out. And that's happening in a way in the United States that's not happening in Europe, for example, where I think there's a very different attitude, by and large, to climate change than you find in the United States and the general populace.
Well, you know, you touch on a couple of things that I think are interesting. Let me ask you about each of them and one at a time. One being how it is you get people to be more future-oriented in their thinking, so that if you have a problem, and I think this comes up often when we're talking about sustainability kind of issues, and when you say to people, well, we really do have a problem right now, but I can tell you that this problem, if we don't do anything, it's just going to continue to get worse. So 10 years, 20 years, 25, 30 years from now, it's really going to be bad. How do you get to people, you know, to get past just the natural very thing that you say, where people would say, look, I got enough stuff to worry about right now, and I can't deal with 10 years and 20 years and 25 years from now?
Well, I think it's a really difficult question. I don't think we have a simple answer to that because it is a kind of problem. Another issue that I've worked on earlier in my life was on radioactive waste. And we described the problem of dealing with that as a 100,000-year problem, for example. Well, how do you get people worried about what's going to happen 100,000 years from now? So I think it's difficult to do. Some people have argued or fear that in the climate change problem, and still, until we start to get some events like New Orleans, for example, that can be attributed to climate change, you're not going to convert people as long as they can say it's a future problem and so forth. Maybe one possibility here is that people are now talking in climate change that there can be some problems so large in the future that are being put in place now by the way we're using energy and the kind of lifestyle we're leading and so forth, that ultimately are going to endanger the planet as a whole. And maybe by interrelating the size of the consequences, that this is not even another nuclear accident or not a problem like the swine flu problem that maybe will end up killing, you know, 50,000 people or something like that. But where you're really talking about endangering the planet as a whole through things that we're doing now, maybe that's a way of trying to convince people. Or maybe we'll find that some of these people are right who say until the events start to happen and people can see it, they're not going to take action on it as long as there are other things going on in their life that they have to worry about, where to get a job at the current time, for example.
Hmm. Well, that I think, though, that partly this might go back to the way that the media covers issues like this, that and maybe we're not in a position to do this, but it seems that every time we come to some new story, that it's big, it's new to us, it's very important, and the way we report it makes it seems to make everything of equal importance. So, as you say, so maybe it ends up seeming like H1N1 is as important as global warming, which is as important as nuclear waste, which is as important. You know, you keep layering on things, and then I'm sure that people get tired real quick of the long list of problems. And maybe part of the problem is in trying to give people the idea that there's some hierarchy here. There's some priority. Some things are actually bigger problems than others.
Yeah, I think I'm reminded by your comment question of a study that was done about 20 years ago by the Environmental Protection Agency. And what it did was it took all the problems that EPA has to deal with, and it had its experts rank all those problems and try to put them from top to bottom in terms of what were most important and so forth. Then they did an experiment, and they had the public make judgments about all those things. And, of course, the lists look very different. And then they did a third interesting thing. They looked at how they were spending their money. And guess what? They found out that the match between where they're spending the money was much more with public perceptions and public concerns than it was with what their own experts thought were the biggest problems and so forth. And that suggests to us that what is driving how we tackle problems and how much attention we pay to them and so forth really doesn't match up very well to scientific or expert opinion. It tends to match up quite well with the political process. And maybe that's why climate change at the current time, if you look at the public polls and so forth that have been done on climate change, it's down sort of toward the bottom of the major problems we're facing. It's not – many people in the scientific community thinks it's the overriding problem of the time. But in public views, it ranks pretty far down in the priorities of the public. So the chance that we're going to allocate large resources as a society to dealing with this problem and to provide some kind of global leadership on this question, one has to be a bit doubtful about that.
We have about 10 minutes left. We have some callers. A question maybe we can try to return to that I think is very interesting is this business of risk and why it is that people generally are pretty bad at deciding what they should be really worried about and, you know, what they don't need to worry as much about. But I will defer here to some callers and see what's on their minds. Chicago is up next, line 4. Hello.
In the beginning, Atomic Energy was presented a letter, I believe, to President Roosevelt by Einstein and a group of scientists who admonished about the use of the discoveries that they've made. And, of course, that wound up becoming the Manhattan Project, leading to the development of all the atomic weaponry we have now in great number around the world. And then we have later on the development of the atomic energy for useful, peaceful purposes. And when the issue came about constructing it, the matter of dealing with the waste was just shuffled to the bottom of the file underneath the desk to be dealt with later in the future. So in terms of being future-oriented, we can see we've let the genie out of the bottle with no hope of controlling it, and we have that problem among us. As Pogo said, we've met the enemy, and the enemy is us. So right from the top, we have this problem when science does present the facts. The policymakers simply either don't go along with it or just put it off for future judgment. So, and even the economist, John Kenneth Galbraith, recently said, never mind being so concerned about the economy and so forth, the atomic energy issue is the greatest one of all right now. So I started off of that as your comment. I'll take an answer off to your thing.
Well, I suppose it sounds like, in fact, the caller is saying that even if the policymakers did read the reports, they might not pay attention or they might not act in the way that science would suggest that they do.
Yeah, and certainly my notion, and I'm sympathetic with some of the concerns that were expressed by that caller. And however, I would say clearly that it may be an imperfect process to have the public officials making these kinds of decisions rather than the scientists, but that's what they're paid to do. And people will note in many cases deciding what is the technology we want to go forward and what is an acceptable risk is a question that can be raised by science but not answered by science. And so for better or for worse, I think it is the job of public officials to make a decision, hopefully informed by science and risk analysis and so forth, but also taking into account public concerns. And nuclear power happens to be one of the areas of greatest discrepancy between how it's evaluated and assessed by scientists and how it's evaluated and assessed by the public. And decision makers have to try to make sense out of that and make good decisions. Not an easy job.
Mm. Mohammed, next, line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I guess I am frustrated by a lack of reference to something like a technical writer or a technical speech writer. I think this would greatly improve the process of communication between the technical side and the general public side, and then possibly that will speed up some of the decision making going out to the public or going to the public officials so that some of the problems are addressed and resolved rather than bouncing around and around and around. I guess that's my comment. Thanks.
Okay. Maybe science fails to take advantage of the fact that there actually are people who are really good at this. You know, maybe they're not scientists, but that there are people who actually can do a pretty good job of taking something that is complicated and putting that into a form where people who are not scientists can understand it.
Yeah, I think that we need help in that area, and we ought to make better use of people of particular skills. We did have a period of time that we tried to upgrade our media through training courses and through hiring people with greater technical expertise. And given all the problems with the economy, we've lost a lot in that area over the last 5 or 10 years. But I also want to caution that it's not just a matter of getting the technical issues right either. There is a problem, I think. Public has a lot of problem handling questions of uncertainty, for example, and most of the things we're talking about are highly uncertain, like climate change, about exactly where the impacts are going to occur and what they're going to be and when they're going to happen and so forth. So that's one problem. But another problem is that there are still important value kinds of questions involved in this. For example, how are we going to, as the most affluent society in the world, with by far the highest per capita emissions of carbon to the atmosphere, what is our responsibility going to be in providing leadership for the globe as a whole in this area? And what is going to be our role? And what is going to be the role of the poorer countries? And we can't resolve that question through just better technical analysis.
Another caller, Champagne, line two. Hello.
Hello. Nice to listen to this discussion. I think it's an absolutely critical point. And the lady who called from Mohammed, the communication is going to be extraordinarily important. As I look at the educational system and having been part of it for almost 40 years, I can assure you there is no time in elementary education to convey the importance of science. No amount of time to address something this significant. And it seems to me that we have very poor political leadership in this respect. They seem to be able to deal only at the basest level with some of these issues. We watch Al Gore. I rode in a plane with his father. His father sat in coach a couple of rows behind me. Al Gore takes an entire retinue and a jet. Ted Kennedy, who I know it's popular to revere him at the moment, but when the wind turbines were going to be placed near Hyannisport, well, you can imagine they disappeared in a hurry. until we see some leadership that is truly meaningful and some education that is truly meaningful and not guided only by those with ultra-conservative politics, I think we have no possibility of addressing these issues sensibly. I'm going to ring off, and maybe you would address real leadership and people you know who have great communication skills in science. Thanks a lot.
All right. Well, what do you think?
Well, first of all, it's hard to improve on the statement that she made, I think. Now, how to get that leadership, and I mean, we have a major effort now going on by this administration to try to upgrade our educational process. It's probably not going to solve this question, but it may be a step in the right direction. I guess I do want to say that I certainly agree that it's a critical need over the longer term for this whole problem area that we're talking about. In climate change, one of the difficulties is we're not going to get enough change in our educational process in time to deal with an urgent problem for which decisions have to be made this year, next year, and the year after. And so we need to improve our educational process, but we're also going to need to do some things immediately and in the interim with problems like climate change. They're urgent now. And so I agree totally with the caller, but also I'm concerned about all the other things that need to happen as well.
We have a couple minutes here, so not very much more time, but I do want to at least touch on the subject of risk and perception of risk among the general public and why it is, and I think it's been demonstrated over and over again, that people are really bad at risk assessment in the sense that they're worried about things that they really don't need to be worried about, and they're not worried about the things that they should be worried about. And why is it that it seems that people are actually, generally speaking, and maybe I'm making a sweeping generalization, you can tell me, but generally speaking, it seems that people are pretty bad at risk assessment?
Let me provide one caution for that.
Okay.
It's not that I disagree that I think that people often focus on running around cleaning off doorknobs and so forth so they won't get exposed to any unhealthy things in the environment. And they may not be wearing their seatbelt, or they may be talking on a cell phone, texting while they're trying to drive, and so forth. So they're really worrying about the wrong problem.
The wrong things, yeah. Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, through many studies that have been made about risk perception, what we do know now is that actually the public is pretty rational by and large on the whole mm-hmm. with how it deals with risk questions, but they do it differently than the experts. So if your evaluation is to say, we're going to take the expert measurement of how many lives are going to be lost over time from this particular technology or this particular activity, we find that the public is including many other things in their assessment besides one or several metrics of what the problem is. So sometimes they're concerned about what it suggests about the management problems. Sometimes they're concerned about equity or value issues. And so they're doing it differently than the scientific experts. So you need to be careful that sometimes they're doing it badly and they're not getting it right, but other times they're just doing it differently and maybe they have it right and the experts don't have it right. And so we need to just not have too much hubris about how we approach this question.
Well, I'm thinking about your earlier example, the one you gave about if you say you go to the EPA and you say, okay, you give me your top 10 list of biggest environmental problems. Okay, so they'll give you a list. And then we go out and we start asking people, what's your top 10 list of environmental problems? And their list is going to be really different from the EPA list. But then you said, but then if you go and you look at what the EPA is spending money on, it looks more like the public list. And I'm sure, understandably, because they've got to somehow be responsive to public opinion and to the political environment. So, well, yeah, I guess they're going to have to spend money on stuff that people think is important. And on the one hand, you might argue, well, that's a problem because we're not getting at the most important things. On the other, you know, politics does have to indeed respond to what people think is important. So is it possible to strike some sort of a middle ground there and both satisfy what the experts say the needs are and to have a system that is politically responsive and responds to what people think is important?
Well, this is some of the argument for having these approaches to be more collaborative and with more stakeholder involvement than we. If it gets isolated off and the scientists are giving all the answers, they're going to miss some things that the public and stakeholders are concerned about and trying to communicate. And I do, my own view is I don't want risk managed through public opinion and so forth. I want public officials who are paid to do this to try to make as good decisions as they can make. And I think that needs to be decisions that are informed by what the scientists have to say and what we know about the risks and so forth. But also, when they find out that there's a big discrepancy between the public and the scientists, I think they need to poke into that and try to understand where those differences are coming from and then make good decisions as best that they can make in the situation.
Well, there we will have to stop. Our guest is this morning, Roger Kasperson. He's a research professor, distinguished scientist in the Graduate School of Geography at Clark University in Worcester, Mass. And he's here on the campus to give a talk on this very subject that is closing the gap between science and practice. This afternoon, 2:30 at Burrell Hall, 124 on Goodwin Avenue. He's here speaking as part of a series of the Social Dimensions of Environmental Policy Initiative, and that's something that's a campus-wide initiative that involves the Department of Geography, School of Earth, Society, and Environment, and the Beckman Institute. And if you'd like to hear more from him, you'd stop by Burrell, 124 Burrell, this afternoon at 2:30, and you can do that. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. Focus 580, this program, is supported in part by Bodywork Associates, offering professional licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982, now with four area locations, including inside the new Activities and Recreation Center north of Memorial Stadium on the U of I campus. More information at bodyworkassociates.com. Support also comes from Radio Maria in downtown Champaign, now with a new dinner menu, tapas, served every evening until 2 a.m., along with lunch on Friday from 10:30 to 2:30, brunch on Saturday and Sunday. Information on menus, wine, and beer lists is at RadioMariaRestaurant.com. That's it for us. We want you to stay tuned, though. Much more coming up this part of the afternoon magazine. The host of the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, our guest will be music journalist John Hartley Fox. We'll talk with him about his book, King of the Queen City, the story of King Records. Right now, we're going to take a look at what's happening in Kansas City and in Chicago with the commodity prices. In Kansas City, December wheat is trading at $5.40. That contract is up 5. March, $5.56 and a quarter, up 6. Chicago, December wheat, $5.37, up 5 and a quarter. March, $5.58, up 5 and three quarters. December corn, $3.89 and a half, down 1. March, $4.04 and a half, down 1 and a quarter. May, $4.14 and three quarters, down 3 quarters. July, $4.22 and a half, down 1 and a quarter. November beans, $9.86 and a half, up 4 and a quarter. January, $9.92 and a half.